Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Marcy Young-Cancio, filling in today for Roger McDonough. We have so much coming up on the program today. Representative Chris Stewart is reportedly in the running for National Intelligence Chief. The Justice Department says mishandling of sexual assault reports at Utah State University left other students vulnerable. A bill about warning labels on pornography advances in the legislature, and a Utah lawmaker proposes banning elective abortions if Roe v. Wade is overturned. Plus, lots more from the state capitol during the third week of the legislative session. Joining me for the conversation today, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry.
Good morning.
Morning, Dan. And reporters Jessica Miller and Bethany Rogers. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
Hi, Bethany.
Hi.
And we invite you to join us for the conversation as well. Call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Tweet us at KCPW or post your questions at sltrib.com. So Jessica Miller, reporter for the Tribune, let's start with the story you've been covering for more than 3 years now. Mm-hmm. The Department of Justice this week said in a report, which you and fellow reporter Courtney Tanner called damning in your reporting, that Utah State University not only mishandled cases of sexual assault, but left, quote, additional students vulnerable. Mm. What were the findings of the DOJ's investigation?
So a lot of the DOJ report is a lot of things that like people we knew about already, right? Like we've been reporting for years about, a particular football player who had been accused of multiple sexual assaults and the university didn't really do much. And in the years before that, there were issues with the fraternities. There were a couple of fraternity members who had been charged with sexually assaulting women at frat houses. You know, more recently, we had issues with the piano department and years of sexual harassment and a report of assault involving the staff there. So a lot of this stuff is things that we've kind of been reporting on over the years, but the DOJ report kind of put it all together and painted a picture of like systemic mishandling of a lot of these cases that left other students vulnerable because these reports of sexual assault weren't being treated adequately at the time.
Right. And so the report started, the investigation by the DOJ started in 2017. Mm-hmm. But as you said, these were cases that went back a lot further. The Tory Green, the student athlete and former student, those dated back to 2015.
Looked at a period between between 2013 and I think somewhere towards the end of 2017. So that encompassed all of the things that were going on with the Greek life, all of the football player situation, touching on the music department. And then there was also just other issues like, campus and housing. If they had a report of a woman saying that she had been sexually assaulted or was being harassed by somebody, they would help her maybe like move out of her apartment or help her in other ways, but they wouldn't alert the Title IX office to that report. And so she wasn't able to get the full services that the university could offer.
Right.
And similarly, that was happening with the police department. They would do a criminal investigation, but then they wouldn't forward that to the Title IX office. So the victims weren't getting the kind of support that the university should have been offering them.
And so this report along those lines found that there were just a lot of failures and a lot of mishandlings of these cases of assault and harassment. And that subjected a lot of other students, dozens probably, well, I think they said dozens, at least, to further harassment and potential of assault. So how was that determined, how is it determined that all of these people were left vulnerable because of the school's mishandling?
Well, with this DOJ report, a lot of it was blacked out, like large blocks of text were redacted because of student privacy. So, you know, you didn't see specific Tory Greene's name never was in this report in an unredacted form, at least. But you could see after these big blocks of redacted text, they would kind of do an overview. Like with the football program, for instance, we had known about Tory Greene and the number of assaults that had been reported with him. But this report says that there were at least 15 reports of sexual assault involving multiple football players, that there were several football players that had been accused of multiple sexual assaults. There were two football staff members who had been one accused of sexual assault, one accused of sexual harassment. So the conclusion is, you know, in a situation like that, had you taken the proper action with the first report, the second report, so on and so forth, you know, it left other women, other people who were later victimized, vulnerable to assaults and harassment.
Right. So a waterfall effect of not handling it appropriately from the get-go.
Exactly.
And just a reminder to folks who are listening, Torrey Greene is a former Utah State student and football player. In March, he was convicted on 8 charges of sexual assault involving 6 women. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And he's serving up to 26 years to life in prison for those, those charges.
And he has one case still pending. So there's another woman where a trial should be coming soon with sexual assault involving her.
And so how, in light of this report, did the university, how has the university responded?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen a lot of changes at the university that, you know, they have been changing over the years. It's not as if this report came out this week and now the changes begin. We saw in 2018, when former students started speaking out about the piano department and the harassment there, they really took that very seriously and, you know, restructured the Title IX office, who was in charge of that office. And so a lot of the changes that the DOJ required in their report were things that the university has been doing over the last 3 years. You know, the students get more training about consent and bystander training. The Title IX office, you know, works a little differently. The staff is getting better training. So I think a lot of the changes that they've been doing, it's something that they've been evolving over the last 3 years.
And so Utah State University actually began its own investigation prior to this DOJ investigation began, like in 2016, right?
They started their own investigation in 2016, specifically involving Torrey Greene and the allegations there. And then they did another investigation involving the piano department. I'm not sure how much they did independently with the fraternity life, but they've been looking at this individually as well. And as part of the DOJ report, you know, they'll be under federal monitoring for the next couple of years. So the DOJ isn't just like going away now. Like they'll be around to make sure that the changes that they're requiring have been put in place.
Right. And the deal there is that if Utah State adheres to these changes and these requirements, that the DOJ will drop any sort of legal action, right?
Right. Yeah. And this is a little bit unusual because a lot of schools, I mean, I think we hear a lot that, you know, a school is under a Title IX investigation. That's pretty typical. I mean, I think at one point, most of the universities in Utah were under some sort of Title IX investigation. Right. But those are usually handled by the Department of Education. And so for the Department of Justice to come in, a separate, you know, department, that they usually come in when it's more of like a systemic issue. Like, for instance, when there was issues in Missoula with campus sexual assaults there, they went in, they did an investigation, and those changes went beyond just the university. The local police department had to make changes. You know, it was more of a community thing.
Right.
We didn't see that as much at Utah State, but it's definitely, it's a bigger deal and a different kind of investigation than your typical Department of Education,
right,
Title IX investigation.
So, while 5 other institutes of higher education in Utah have been or are currently under investigations through Title IX, just Utah State has had that more serious investigation by the Department of Justice.
Right, exactly.
Okay. And you talked a little about some of those other incidents that the DOJ investigated, the Greek system, the music department, and then within the athletics department. All of those things contributed to the changes that the school has been making over recent years, different types of mishandling in each of those cases, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think we just have seen an evolution of how, you know, I'm not quite sure they made a whole lot of changes with the Greek life. That was around, like, you know, 2014, 2015. And then, you know, 2016, after the Tribune did a report about, you know, the mishandlings of the Torrey Greene cases, they did internal review, made some changes. Then as the piano department stuff comes out, you know, then they go back again, make even more changes. I think the more dramatic changes that we saw was around probably more like 2018, like after the piano department. So it's been something they've been evolving over the years after, you know, these little issues pop up in the different corners of campus.
And so is this report prompting any new changes that they weren't already working toward prior to the release of the report?
I'm not sure if there is anything new. It's not anything like incredibly dramatic. Like most of it is stuff that they've already been doing and they're just going to be continuing to do.
Okay. So is there the DOJ, if the school continues with these changes, won't pursue legal action, but what about other legal action or civil suits. Is that in any, are there any talks about that happening?
There are a couple pending civil lawsuits right now. There's a couple of the women who said that they were sexually assaulted by Tory Greene who have sued the university, saying that they mishandled those reports. A woman who was sexually assaulted by a fraternity member, she sued a year or two ago and they settled with her. And as part of her settlement, they also promised new changes with how they handle fraternity life. So we're definitely seeing a lot of, like, now is the time where we're seeing a lot of those civil lawsuits starting to pop up and go through the system.
And those are also influencing the changes that the school's been making.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Jessica, thanks. And thanks to Courtney Tanner, who covered this story with you. Before we move on to our next story, a reminder to listeners to join us for this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. So Jessica, we're going to stay with you for a little bit longer. This next story looks at police busts of illicit massage parlors across the Valley, mostly. Mm-hmm. You and your colleague Peyton Harkins question whether undercover officers let touching go too far in these massages. So tell us. Tell us about this story.
Okay. Oh, man, where to begin with this story? So this is a story that we started. I had been looking at some search warrants and noticed that there was there was a notation on one warrant that talked about a police officer having his genitals touched during an undercover massage sting. And that kind of brought up a lot of questions like, whoa, I didn't realize that this was happening. And like, how long does the touching go on for? And when do the other officers like come in and bust them or whatever it is that they're doing? And so we found out that it kind of depends, like, on each department, how much sexual touching they are comfortable with when they're doing these undercover stings, trying to, you know, suss out whether these were illicit massage parlors that were offering sex acts more than just the massages.
Right. So what discrepancies were you finding from department to department and the way that these busts or stings are handled?
Well, for instance, Unified Police Department, they allow this kind of touching. They said about half of the time, one detective I spoke to said about half the time there is some form of touching of an officer's genitals before before the police, you know, burst in and make the arrest or serve the search warrant. There's other departments such as Bountiful Police say, you know, they'll send an undercover officer in, but they're very much prohibited from having any sort of sexual touching. There are some that say that they don't really want the officers to do it, but if it happens, you know, they're not going to get in trouble for it. You know, it's not explicitly against the rules. So it's kind of a weird gray area where some are like kind of okay with it as long as it's limited. Some are not totally okay with it, but you're not going to get in trouble for it. And then there's some that don't really want it to be happening at all.
And so with Unified, what is the justification that they make as to why it's okay if it does happen during the course of a sting?
Well, that was my big question, because if you look at Utah's sex solicitation laws, all that's required for the law to be broken is a verbal agreement that you will exchange sex for money. You don't need any sort of sexual touching. That's not a requirement. And so when I asked him that, he told me that, you know, oftentimes the women in these massage parlors don't speak English fluently. And so there's a language barrier. And so they can't really verbally agree to a deal, or they won't agree to a deal because they might think maybe this is a cop.
Right.
So they're not going to, you know, talk explicitly about what they're offering here. And so they're saying that with that language barrier, that there's not much else you can do to show that these illicit massages are happening until it's like escalates to that point where there is some sort of sexual touching.
Okay. And sexual touching beyond it is something that happens beyond kind of the course of what would happen in a
right, because there's obviously some regular
massage. Right?
But you have to do some touching with the regular massage. But this is kind of more where, it becomes more of a sexual nature where they're touching the genitals of the police officer.
Right. And this isn't just about, when it comes to these massage parlors, it's not just about the touching, but also a lot of concerns around human sex trafficking. And so what's the balance between bringing charges against a massage parlor worker, mm-hmm. And that balance with sex trafficking?
I think that's what made this story so complicated to report, because it's not like for a police office, a police department, if they are uncomfortable with, you know, this sort of touching going on, just eliminating this form of investigation or, you know, just ignoring massage parlors, I don't think is really an option for them, because there are a lot of women and, you know, people who work for these that are trafficked here, and they view that as something very important that they are, you know, that they're trying to combat. But, you know, on the other hand, like a lot of critics say, like, is it really helpful to a woman who's being trafficked that, you know, you made her touch your genitals and then you arrested her and then now she's got a criminal record? Right. Is that really the help that we should be giving victims of human trafficking?
Right. And you talked to former Salt Lake Police Department Chief Chris Burbank for the story. And when he was the chief here in Salt Lake, they actually disbanded the vice department for a little bit to address that very thing.
Yeah.
To take the criminalization, the charges and the criminalization off of the massage workers, but on the buyers and the massage parlor owners.
Right. Well, they disbanded theirs because the
Well, they disbanded it for something else. And when they came back,
there was a lot of touching, right. More touching going on with the Salt Lake City Police Department at that time than even what we saw more recently. There was much more sexual touching going on back then. But yeah, he disbanded it and then they brought it back and they focused it more on the buyers and, you know, the criminal network that goes along with this. And that's kind of what experts say the focus should be on. It shouldn't be kind of like a whack-a-mole approach of just like random sex workers, but focused more on, you know, business licenses or like the men who are paying for these services. In a lot of these cases we saw, they testified, you know, they came to court and testified about the sex acts they received, and they were never under threat of prosecution. They were very clear about that in their testimony, that the prosecutors never said that they would prosecute them or, you know, they needed to testify or else they would be charged. They were just doing it because they thought it was the right thing to do. And so some experts say that focusing on the buyers is where the focus should be instead.
I mean, and this is a big money-making industry. The Polaris Project, which is a national nonprofit focusing on human trafficking, estimates that there's more than 9,000 massage businesses like this across the country, and they bring in a collective $2.5 billion a year.
Right.
I mean, that's so what do these experts say the best approach is then when it comes to cracking down on these illegal massage parlors?
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, focusing on the business license is a big one. You know, focusing on the buyers, focusing on the criminal network. You know, our Chris Burbank kind of served as like our local expert. And, you know, he totally disagrees that any sort of touching should ever be a part of this. You know, he kind of likened it to old, you know, bad cop dramas where someone has to, you know, a cop has to take a line of coke to show that he's not really a police officer. And so, you know, that's not really how we do things anymore. And he doesn't see why. And this kind of touching should ever be allowed.
Right. And he even went as far to say that a police officer, quote, in fact, committed the crime and then arrested this other person for that crime. So even going as far to say that if police officers are being touched sexually in this way during a massage, that they're potentially responsible for committing a crime.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, we look at some of these police reports and some of it, I mean, there's one in particular that we used in our story where the massage parlor worker had told him, like, you know, you're done, tapped him on the leg, said, you know, your service is done. And he was the one who urged her to continue, who pointed, you know, to his genitals and, you know, told her to keep going. And so I think that it's cases like that where you wonder, or where, you know, some might say it's becoming borderline entrapment, or like, you know, that the officer is the one who's creating the crime.
Right. Well, there's so much more in this story that we could talk about. It's an incredibly in-depth and well-reported story. So I encourage all of our listeners to go and give it a read at saltlaketrib.com, sltrib.com.
Mm-hmm.
Ignore that first one, sltrib.com, but go give it a read. It's great. And so that brings us to our first break. Coming up, Utah's Representative Chris Stewart could be President Trump's next intelligence director, and bills from pornography to polygamy. We'll have a roundup from week 3 of the 2020 legislative session. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Marcy Young Cancio, in for Roger McDonough. And I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Bethany Rogers, and government and politics editor Dan Harry. Join us with your questions and comments. Post them to Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or tweet us at KCPW. Dan Harry, we're going to start with you on this next one. Utah Representative Chris Stewart is said to be in the running for the Director of National Intelligence gig. This would make him the number one guy over the nation's intelligence community, which is made up of 17 agencies. What elevates Stewart as a top contender?
Well, as the New York Times reported, the president's national security advisor, O'Brien, was the guy who's supposedly pushing Chris Stewart. And Stewart is a major in the Air Force. He was a fighter pilot. He also is on the House Intelligence Committee. And most importantly in this administration, he's a very loyal Trump supporter.
Right, and loyalty has certainly been a big conversation point in coming in the
loyalty
last several
is the
weeks,
thing.
Especially. Right. So this is a position that's been filled by an interim director since August, and by law is required to step down in the next month. So the Trump administration is really being forced to make a decision pretty quickly. March 11th, I think, is that deadline. So going back to that loyalty, what is the significance about this potential appointment?
Well, of significance, I think, is the fact that while on the House Intelligence Committee and, demonstrating this loyalty to the president, Chris Stewart has very much been critical of some of the intelligence agencies. For instance, he has always been one who did not accept the unanimous findings of the intelligence community that Russia interfered in the 2016 election and decided that they wanted Donald Trump to be elected. He has never accepted that. And that's despite the unanimous findings of all the intelligence community, which is not all that common when they agree on everything like that. But yeah, he's rejected that and still rejects it. For a long time, he was skeptical of the notion that the Russians were interfering in the election and that it made much difference. So while they don't speak out of school very much, you can imagine that some in the intelligence community are a bit worried about this. If they get the new boss whose main loyalty is to the president over the agencies, then obviously they would be worried that would kind of really undermine our intelligence capabilities in the country.
Right.
On the other hand, others say, the president sets our policies on foreign policy and other issues and that, you should be loyal to the president. I think what we're seeing play out right now with the attorney general is he loyal to the president or loyal to the agencies that he oversees becomes an increasing question in the administration we're
right.
seeing.
And this is a conversation we've seen really for a while, but it's really started coming up, particularly over the last couple of days. So it's interesting that this conversation about this appointment is happening
right.
amid all of that. So how would Stewart's likely appointment be? How is it being received by both the left and the right now?
Well, we've yet to really see if this reported consideration becomes more, concrete, then we're going to start to see a lot
right.
more reaction. I think Democrats would be very leery of this happening. But on the other hand, they really wouldn't have the votes to try to prevent this. And, what we've seen in this administration also is, as you mentioned, acting director. Well, that's what we see in a lot of these agencies is we have acting directors. So really, the president can name an acting director without confirmation in the Senate.
Right.
So if that's the way he wants to do it and that's the pattern that he's established, he can do so at his whim.
Right. All right. Thanks, Dan. We are going to keep moving this along because we have tons to talk about from the Utah legislature. But before we do that, I want to remind listeners to join our conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. All right. So that takes us into our next story, really a bunch of stories. The Utah legislature is wrapping up week three of the 2020 session, and there are plenty of bills to discuss. Bethany Rogers, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, you've been spending a lot of time up on the Hill. Tell us about the bill that, should the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade, would almost immediately ban elective abortions.
Yeah, this is a bill that is expected to be sponsored by Senator Dan McKay. The language actually has not been released publicly yet. So what we know about it is what he's told us. And he has said that, as you mentioned, that the bill would essentially ban all elective abortions as soon as the Supreme Court allows. Until that time, until the Supreme Court is to make a ruling that would overturn Roe versus Wade, it would just sit ineffective, sort of dormant in state law, just kind of waiting for that day. But the point of it, I guess, is so that if there is a high court ruling along those lines, this could kind of take effect immediately, that the Utah legislature wouldn't have to come back in a special session or wait until the next general session to kind of exercise the ability to pass these strict restrictions.
Right. And so that's typically what we've seen around bills around abortion, is bills will be passed and then it gets kicked back to the higher courts, and then it's in the state of limbo. So he's trying to cut out all of that limbo should Roe v. Wade be overturned.
Exactly. And also, the other point of the trigger clause is to avoid immediate litigation. So because, Roe versus Wade is still kind of the case law that everybody operates under, trying to pass a law that would ban abortions in the state essentially would invite an immediate legal challenge.
Right.
And the state is actually already in court over an abortion law that it passed last year. So, you know, there's not really much of an appetite to pass another bill that would kind of initiate another round of litigation.
Right.
And this is a way of avoiding that.
And that bill last year has wouldn't ban elective abortions, but it would say that they would be illegal after 18 weeks.
Yes,
right?
Yes, an 18-week ban.
All
yep.
Right. So McKay has announced the plans for this bill back in July, saying that he would spend the months in between researching the issue and trying to, quote, balance all of the rights and interests. What does he mean by that?
He told me that he wanted to kind of look back at, the way that we've the years since Roe versus Wade, the Roe versus Wade ruling happened, and just kind of review where we're at. He told me he, looked at some of the medical advances. That's something that he mentioned. He feels that we've gotten to a point where society in general is much more supportive of women. There's more resources available for people with unplanned pregnancies. And so, after sort of taking stock of everything, it appears that he pretty much landed exactly where he started. So he had announced from the beginning, as you said, back in July, that he was going to explore legislation exactly like this.
Right.
And so after kind of, looking at where we are in medicine, the services that we provide, he kind of landed right back at that place where he essentially just wants to ban all abortions with a few minor or a few limited exceptions.
And those exceptions would be for in cases of incest or rape, or
incest
if the mother's life is,
yes,
at risk.
Exactly.
Right? And so McKay also makes this argument that if the bill, going back to what you were saying, that if this bill were to pass, society may better support pregnant women in a way that it hadn't previously. And he said, quote, "The scarlet letter days, I hope, are far behind us." Can you explain what he means by that? Or what did he say he means by that?
He kind of let that comment stand on its own. He was talking at the time about the level of supports that society provides to people with who are experiencing unplanned pregnancies, or who maybe, don't have a supportive partner or supportive family. So I think what he was referring to is just, the ability for people to, support and help a woman in that situation,
right,
rather than shunning.
Right. So that stigmas around unplanned pregnancies, or
right,
all of the pregnancies that people might choose to end an abortion, that the stigmas around that have changed. So therefore, you don't need to have an abortion.
Yes, I think that's what he was getting at.
Not that you can speak for him, but just trying to break that quote down a little bit. So also, 2 months before he announced that he was planning on this bill, his wife, who is a Riverton City Councilwoman, Tawny McKay, made news when she proposed an anti-abortion resolution that passed in the council, say, making the city a sanctuary city for the unborn. What role has she played in this bill and moving it forward?
He said she's really been extremely influential in his thinking process. I mean, he said, you know, maybe it's difficult for a male legislator to bring a bill like this forward, but he said, you know, my wife has really been talking me through this the entire way and is very supportive. And he said that she is going to be coming to testify on support of his bill when it appears in a legislative committee. So I think that, you know, he's been talking to her as sort of, you know, to get a woman's perspective on the issue, and that she is, you know, really encouraging him to push forward with this effort.
So it's a tag team kind of approach toward this bill. All right, yes, Dan, please jump in.
And the reason that got so much attention in Riverton was, you know, we don't see this kind of wedge issue politics in city, at this level of city government. So this was really unusual. And there were a lot of folks, no matter which side of the fence they were on, that were upset that, you know, you're bringing this kind of issue down to the local level, where, generally speaking, you've got groups of people that, no matter their views on abortion and these larger issues, you know, they're there to fix potholes and fund public parks and, you know, help the community. And so that's why this thing was so controversial.
So to bring in a lightning rod federal issue seemed kind of out of left field for the city level.
Yeah.
And I remember we talked about that on this show back in May. Interesting. Well, thanks, Bethany. We're going to stay with you as we move on to the next story because, you know, all the bills from the Hill. Next up, we are going to I want to hear a little bit about this story that lawmakers are taking on, that lawmakers are essentially taking on pornography distributors, saying that they are done, quote, playing nice. Tell us about this one. And that's a quote from your story.
Yes.
Not a lawmaker.
So this is a bill that Representative Brady Brammer brought forward that would essentially require all distributors of pornography in the state of Utah to attach a warning label that would warn of the effects of pornography on minors. And if they do not comply, they could be liable for pretty steep fines. So, you know, anybody basically who notices that there's some pornography without the warning label on it could contact the distributor and basically demand a $500 payment from them. And
have they set those terms for what they could? This is one of the most interesting pieces of the story. That the fines, I think you reported, were like $2,500. But
yes, if they go to court, they could be liable for up to $2,500.
And so if mom or a dad or anybody sees porn without this label on it, they could report it and then be like, I'd like a cut of that, please.
Yeah, so there's in the bill, there's actually a form letter that the person would basically fill out and send to the distributor and be like, hey, I noticed, you know, I stumbled across this magazine, or I, you know, was online and, you know, the pornography didn't have a label preceding it. And they could say you're out of compliance, and then the distributor would have the decision of whether to just ignore the letter or just like pay up and also offer proof that it had come into compliance.
Okay, so the retailer of this material wouldn't be responsible. It would be the person who sold the literature or whatever to that retailer.
Yeah, it would be the distributor or the producer.
Okay.
So anymore, you know, so much of this is digital that most of the conversation has focused around websites.
Okay. So what people are finding when they're online.
Yeah, exactly.
So this raises a lot of questions. Some of the people who are against this, mostly like you cited the ACLU, which is worried about a chilling effect on free speech. And that raises the question of if anyone can report this, what is considered porn or obscene material? Does this have a clear definition of what needs to have a label? Like, are we talking the swimsuit edition at Sports Illustrated
no.
online?
And so Representative Brammer you know, his position is that it will be relatively clear-cut, that whole, like, you know it when you see it idea. He said, you know, there's no way that anybody is going to try to, you know, flag the Venus de Milo or flag, you know, the anatomy book or something like that. This eventually, like, if the distributor were to ignore the demand letter, could make its way into court. And his expectation would be that it would only kind of be like the worst case, the most obvious cases that would end up in this position. The legislation uses the term pornography,
right,
and kind of leaves it at that. The state law does contain some definitions around pornography, talking about, you know, it's intended to be sexually stimulating,
right, the pure
erotic
interests
material
of the community,
exactly,
all of that, right? So the language on the Representative Brammer has come up with some language for that bill,
yes,
too, that says that it can impair a minor's, quote, brain development, emotional development, and the ability to maintain intimate relationships. How have porn distributors responded to this?
So some of them have been outraged and, you know, complained about a chilling effect, complained that this is kind of a sort of a moralistic approach that would require compelled speech that they don't agree with. They, you know, say, you know, what's your evidence that of all these horrible impacts of pornography? And then others have kind of taken a more lighthearted tone. There was one website that kind of decided to troll the state of Utah by creating a warning label sort of preemptively.
Right. And I have the language of that quote.
Yeah, okay.
It's so great.
I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Their warning label says, quote, porn may lead to decreased stress, increased happiness, and lower rates of teen pregnancy.
Yes. So
trolling those ideas of what was in Brammer's pre-written label.
Exactly. So apparently anybody from Utah currently who goes and visits that website will read that warning label.
Okay. So lots of warnings.
Yes.
Depending on what you're scared of there. So good. All right. It's now time for another break. Still up, Utah's Clean Air Caucus has rolled out a long list of to-dos for 2020. And could polygamy in Utah finally be decriminalized? This is Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Marcy Young-Cancio, filling in for Roger McDonough. And I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune's reporters Jessica Miller and Bethany Rogers and editor Dan Harry. It's our Friday morning news roundup. And you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting us at KCPW. So we've just spent... We're spending this last half of the show talking a lot about what's happening up on the Hill. And so we're going to stay with Bethany Rogers, who has been up at the Hill all session. Now we're on to air quality. So also up on the Hill this week, lawmakers in the Clean Air Caucus rolled out an ambitious slate of goals for 2020. What's on this to-do list?
There were about two dozen bills on the list that they talked about at a press conference this last week. And it dealt with everything from expanding electrical vehicle charging networks to providing financial incentives for people to trade in, you know, their older, more polluting cars for cleaner, more eco-friendly cars. There were some planning proposals. There's Senator Anderegg's proposal for creating a statewide rail network plan that would incorporate environmental considerations into that and also deal with the inland port and you know, how to make that, you know, cleaner transportation network. So, yeah, it was just a hugely ambitious, wide-ranging list of proposals that they're hoping to get passed.
Great. And so just over a month ago, Governor Gary Herbert urged the legislature to invest $100 million into air quality. How could that potentially impact these goals? And is that $100 million a sure thing?
It's not a sure thing. So the governor's budget proposal was based on some old revenue estimates. Shortly after the session began, there were some revisions to the revenue estimates that meant there was a lot less money on the table. We're supposed to get an updated revenue estimate, but for the last few weeks, it's been a very tight budget, at least on the general fund side, where a lot of these projects, all this project funding would be coming from. So at this point, you know, lawmakers are uncertain how much of these things will actually be able to be funded.
And did they put a price tag? Did the Clean Air Caucus put a price tag on what they thought these projects would cost?
So the bulk of the spending would actually be related to the $100 million that the governor requested. So a couple of lawmakers put in appropriations requests on behalf of the governor. And the largest chunk of that funding would be for expanding the electrical vehicle charging network. That would be kind of the main push so that people would feel comfortable, you know, driving further afield. They wouldn't have as much range anxiety that they were going to, you know, leave.
And statewide, this isn't just
right.
So you can actually maybe drive down to St. George if you have an electric vehicle.
Exactly. They talked about, you know, people who have electric vehicles being anxious to go too far afield because you don't know where the next electric charging station is going to be. So just providing more dependability for people could encourage people to purchase those cars.
Right. Right. Good. Well, I know I almost got stuck in Park City on the side of the road for that very reason, so that is personally appealing. So Salt Lake's air quality is notoriously bad, despite getting a bit better in recent years. But the population in the valley is also booming. So how would these goals balance the growth in population and not only keep air quality from getting worse, but actually improving?
Yeah, so one thing that a lot of, you know, both advocates and lawmakers are paying more attention to is building pollution. And so several of the proposals have to do with how to, you know, build cleaner. Buildings are supposed to overtake cars as the main source of emissions in the next few years here. So one of the proposals that was brought forward by Representative Arendt would create a voluntary sort of pilot program that would provide more information to home sellers and home buyers about the efficiency of a house before they buy it, just to better educate people as they're, you know, thinking about buying a home.
Okay.
A couple of bills would sort of incentivize battery storage in buildings, to harness solar energy and be better able to use renewable sources than currently. So those are a couple of ways that they're looking at to, sort of develop, but in a cleaner way.
Okay. And those are both for private homes as well as commercial businesses?
Yeah.
Okay. And with all of the development that's been happening in the Salt Lake Valley, have a lot of these buildings taken on green building practices that would help with air quality, or is that something that has been proposed as part of these goals?
So there has been some sort of like green or net zero development. I think that it's not as commonplace as a lot of people would like to see. But
particularly as we see this boom.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that there is being more and more attention being paid to that now, especially, like I said, as there's been progress made on tailpipe emissions. I think that the focus is moving more towards buildings.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Bethany.
Sure.
It's a lot more happening up at the legislature. So please follow sltrib.com for all of the stories that they're covering, because certainly there are way more than what we're able to get through in this hour. And Dan, we're going to turn to you for our last story from the Hill. This was a story written by Tribune reporter Benjamin Wood. On Monday, in an act of bipartisan unity, the Senate unanimously approved a bill that would decriminalize polygamy. What would that bill do exactly if passed?
Right. So it would still make polygamy illegal, but it would make it an infraction. So it would be like getting a traffic ticket. No jail time, no arrest. You would just get a citation. That's for the polygamy between consenting adults.
But then if you're doing heroin, you get pulled over for driving and get that traffic ticket.
And more commonly in these prosecutions, if they're prosecuted, are fraud, you know, food stamp fraud, other kinds of fraud. What we're seeing with the Washakie case going on, huge fraud. Sexual abuse, you know, child abuse, those kinds of things still would remain a felony.
Right. So if there's a compounding crime that's happening alongside that,
right.
that traffic ticket
right.
with polygamy, then that's
so,
where you would
So be the idea that things that really are the only cases that are being prosecuted ever involving these other more serious crimes, those would still be on the books as a felony and still could be, you know, prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But the consenting adults who practice polygamy without committing other crimes, they get a slap on the hand and be sent off.
Right. And those other crimes are things that Spanish Fork Senator Deidre Henderson, who sponsored this bill, has called a full-blown human rights crisis when it comes to polygamy and the decriminalization of it, right?
Right.
And what does she mean by that?
Well, I think that what we saw, you know, generations ago where there was actual prosecution of polygamists, that families were destroyed, you know, everyone involved in that, including those who wanted the prosecutions, realized it turned out to be a huge mistake. And it was a huge political embarrassment for those, too. So, you know, you can't really take that approach to polygamy. I know Nate was on the show last week, and he said the best estimates out there are about 30,000 polygamists in Utah. So, I mean, you know, that's a good chunk of people out there.
It's a medium-sized city.
And so right now, many of those people feel disenfranchised. They feel like even though these cases aren't being actively practiced when there's no other crime involved, that they could be. And so they're taught, you know, as young children, to kind of stay in the shadows, to not participate fully in society. And so I think that's what she's referring to.
And so if this bill were to pass, the actual impact in communities would look like what? People would be more willing to come forward? And how could this actually impact some of these polygamous families or groups?
I can only speculate, but I would imagine, for instance, that polygamists would become more civically engaged, that they would have lobbyists at the legislature. I think they do now, but I think that you would see, you know, maybe rallies of polygamists that you don't see now, those kinds of things. So, you know, it sounds in theory like it would be a positive thing.
Right. And this is just kind of an interesting full circle on Utah's long history with polygamy.
Right.
Which was...
And remember, too, that this bill has only passed out of committee. It's got a long way to go.
Right.
And given the history, which some are embarrassed about, some are defensive about, I don't think that this bill is a sure bet by any means.
Okay. Interesting. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it. And you can follow along with the Salt Lake Tribune all legislative session to find out what happens with that bill and all of the other bills we've talked about, plus all of the many bills we didn't talk about. And that brings us to our underplayed stories of the week, which I have been calling hashtag, in case you missed it, with the acronym, of course. And so we've reached that time where we want to hear from our panel of your favorites. Jessica, let's start with you.
I'm going to pick a story that Peyton Harkins wrote about law enforcement's use of facial recognition technology. You know, lawmakers last year were alarmed when they learned that the feds had used facial recognition technology to scan our driver's license photos in Utah. But it turns out we did a poll recently, and most of the poll respondents are very okay with this kind of technology and the police using facial recognition technology. So just interesting that we had our, you know, elected leaders kind of in an uproar, but the general Utah population are totally fine with this.
Well, this is a great time to ask our listeners to join that conversation. If you have any opinion about this facial recognition software, tell us, tweet us. Do you care? Do you not care? We will be paying attention to those tweets all day long. You don't have to do it within the hour. Great. Thanks, Jessica. Bethany.
I really enjoyed a story by Becky Jacobs in honor of the 150th anniversary of women's suffrage in Utah. It was about the really interesting connection between women gaining the ability to vote in Utah and polygamy in Utah.
Yeah. And plus lots of cosplay up at the Capitol this
week,
right?
Yeah.
Lots of people dressed up in kind of that suffrage movement to draw attention to that. Great. That was a great piece. And Dan, we'll go to you now.
I'm going to pick a story that's in the Tribune today, and that is about a legislator trying to get $500,000 to sue the city of Richmond and its attempt to block coal shipments through its port there.
Okay.
The legislator who's asking for the money calls it a slander on Utah.
All right. Well, you can read that at sltriv.com. And I will end with Courtney Tanner's story about a Black History Month at BYU, where two students speaking about the immigrant experience and being Black were posed anonymous racist questions before a mostly white audience. Those questions included, what percentage of African Americans are on food stamps? Why do African Americans hate the police? And why don't we have any white people on stage? BYU officials say that they were not able to ID these commenters, but are committed to promoting this culture of safety and kindness at their school. Thank you to Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller, Bethany Rogers, and to government and politics editor Dan Harry for joining us this morning. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to KCPW Operations Director Jesse Ellis and the team at Utah Radio Public Radio in Logan. Find podcasts of this and all of KCPW's local programs at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. You can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook at KCPW88.3 or on Twitter at KCPW. I'm Marcy Young-Cancio. Thanks for joining us this morning and have a great weekend. Roger McDonough will be back next week.